Good evening, everybody. It is the April 18th meeting of the City Council. Let's rise together and salute our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, everyone. Please be seated, and we'll now have our roll call by our city clerk.
Councilmembers are here. Councilmember Hanson.
Here.
Councilmember Olson.
Here.
Councilmember Chet Taylor.
Here.
Councilmember Watson.
Present.
Councilmember Birch.
Here.
Councilmember Goodrich.
Here.
Very good. This is our public comment time. We are invited and welcome to speak about anything that's not on the agenda. If it's on the agenda, we'll have time for you to talk later. So if you'd like to talk, you get 3 minutes. Come up, introduce yourself, where you live, and I'd like to have you. Welcome.
Well, thank you. My name is Grace, 5913 Vista Drive. I live in Ferndale. Last week, I sent a letter to the Ferndale City Council, and I was prompted to send that because of what was in the newspaper in terms of the city considering roundabouts, right turns, left turns, synchronized lighting, street lighting. And somehow, to me, it seems like what the city council is really missing is that you keep adding dwelling units. Each dwelling unit adds 2.2 cars per unit. So let's see, a while back, there was a housing development that was for 300 units. That's 600 cars. You've got the Henderson now. There's a development on Henderson, 44 units. That's 88 cars. You got anywhere, everywhere you look, you see development. You see more dwelling units being built. All that is more automobiles on the roadways in Ferndale. I really think you have to step back and examine the number of dwelling units and the number of automobiles coming in and out of Ferndale. And that's why I'd ask for a moratorium on any new dwelling permits on the west side of I-5 until the Thornton overpass is completed. I mean, I think that's one way to think about gridlock and how we solve the traffic problems, because the bottom line is there's just one main in and out and then a side in and out. You got to make the in and out bigger. You can't just solve it by traffic lights. So that's it.
Thank you for coming today. Appreciate
it. Thank
very
you
much.
Appreciate it.
Anyone else this evening? Mr. Robinson.
I'm Papa John, and I still live at Molloy House, 6072 Molloy Avenue, Ferndale. And I have tonight, I'm going to use my 3 minutes on, I've already checked with one of our astute city council persons here about this brilliant idea to help raise new taxes. But I want to say ahead of time now that I think part of the revenue at least should go specifically and directly to the police department to increase the pay of those who have to deal with this tax. And I also think it's the basis of this is a tax on licensing, which we now have to license part of the population that I'm going to be talking about. But first I have to give you context, which of course is a criminal that's texting. I go down to the mall because I'm a minister and I love to give people brilliant ideas because people say I'm full of it and I'm sure they mean ideas. And I noticed that Target, there's this big sign that says pets. But to my utter dismay, and they actually asked me to put this in writing after I called this to their attention, what I noticed was there's absolutely no food, no water, no leashes, and no collars at all for pet peeves, which got me to thinking, there's an untaxed source right there. You guys, everybody has at least one pet peeve. So since you have to license dogs and cats and other pets, how about just starting taxing pet peeves? And you would tax them by the size. The bigger the pet peeve, the more you'd have to tax them, of course. And then I'm also thinking, I shared this with my pastor yesterday, instead of car washes for youth, they could do have signs that says, we will pet your peas while you're at work. You charge them again by their size and by how long you pet them. So anyhow, just food for thought for a new source of revenue for the community. And you're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Abdul. We'll refer that to our treasurer to see if that's something we might apply in the future. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to the city council? Ms. Marla, come up front. Good to see you again.
Marla Morrow, Ferndale, Washington, 5595 Elder Road. I want to extend a very sincere thank you to the city of Ferndale for the tremendous success of the Ferndale Cherry Blossom Festival, which was held on this past Saturday, April 16th. We had over 300 people in attendance, and one of our missions was to have an intergenerational populace attend. We had babes in arms, and there was a woman who was 102 years old who came. So I think this event was wonderful in that it showcased Ferndale as a city that embraces the richness of cultural diversity, and it will mark Ferndale once again as a destination rather than just a thoroughfare from here to there. So thank you, each one of you, for your support.
Thank you, Marla.
Marla, I want to ask Council to join me in thanking you, Marla, and the Arts Commission for doing such a great job. It was a lot of fun. The weather was perfect. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Anybody else want to speak to us tonight? Come on forward, sir.
My name is Patrick Dahl. I'm a resident of Ferndale, 5603 Imhoff Road. I'm the builder of the Ferndale Bike Park. I got a couple of things I'd like to cover. One of them being, I hate to ask you guys for a favor. I need to get a job box out there. I tried to find one for a donation for the park. It doesn't have to be brand new. It could be used. I could paint it with a can of Rattle Kinks. I'm sure some kids will tag it and I'll have to paint it again. But, yeah, I need a job box that's like 4 feet wide by 3 feet tall by 2 feet wide or depth, just to put shovels and rakes and hoses in, because occasionally I have kids that want to help me work out there, like your son, who don't have a car, have no way of bringing their own tools, and I'm only available on Sundays now because I work in Bellevue and I got to commute. So, yeah, I was wondering if I can get a little help with that. If you guys, the utility department has one kicking around that's been beat up and they don't need. These recycling, I can get one at the cost of scrap for 50 cents on the pound, but the bad thing is the ones they have are like 300 pounds.
Mm.
And they're way bigger than I need. They're bigger than my closet. Well, the little part of the closet my wife lets me have. And then the other thing is public bathroom. The part that's not gated by the ConocoPhillips fields. The deal was when I got the park going was that I find a bathroom source, and Rob Northhouse helped me find a bathroom for the park. And I was all about it. I was excited about it. Baker Septic brought me the outhouse, and it got used pretty well by the kids that would come to the park. The problem is I went out there one day, and there was no toilet paper in it. I went out there a few days later. There was still no toilet paper in it. The outhouse had feces smeared inside of it. And then it got cleaned, and I came out there one day, and they had a softball tournament down in the park. And I don't know if you guys have ever hung out down at the park for the softball tournaments. All right. I'm an alcoholic. 3 years this month in sobriety. And I go into the bathroom, and it's covered in puke. I'm guessing somebody was drunk, couldn't hold their booze. And finally, Rob Northhouse had contacted me by email and said that they're wanting their outhouse back because it's starting to get rattle can now, and it was the end of the season, so nobody was going to be out there. So I was like, yeah, take it. So then I went out there in early May the following spring, and they had a flag football tournament going on. There was no bathrooms at all. And I was seeing guys' dinglings hanging out, so they go use the bathroom and wherever they go, because like, that's for guys and that's what we do. But then I was out there digging with my five-year-old this last weekend, and on the main line where you go down the drop-in, within crashing distance of the main line, you know, my kid's over there playing around, and all of a sudden he's like, hey, Dad, is that human poop? So I walked over, I looked, and somebody had pooped right off the sideline of the main line because there's nowhere to go. You know, it's crashing distance. You crash your bike, you're going down in the dirt, you're getting cuts and scrapes, and to get up and find that you've rolled through someone's poop, it's kind of gross. There's nowhere to go to the bathroom in that park. Nowhere at all. So I'm just asking if Brendel maybe start looking, instead of focusing on roundabouts, on this problem over here because they're supposed to fix it over here. Maybe put some money in that park and get us a bathroom, man. There's a neat little house there that needs a lot of work, but it can be torn down. I mean, put a bathroom there.
Thank you, Patrick. No, you've hit some buttons that we've all discussed before, but let's make sure we get this back to Public Works Committee in the next week or two, okay? Both those are very important needs,
right.
and let's work on a little bit.
Contact me, email, do that.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for coming. I appreciate it. Well, I wanted everybody on council to hear.
No problem.
Thank you so much.
Anyone else? Very good. Thank you for coming. Going on the next thing, we have some new staff members, and I'm going to invite our city financial director, Mark Peterson. He has two new folks working for him that we get to introduce tonight.
We have two pretty darn new members of our finance team. Mandy Simmons is here. She does utility billing, and Mandy was with us in the court area a few years back, and she came back to us in finance. That's so nice. And Sherry DeYoung is our accounts payable person. She's been here a short time, worked in the city of Bellingham as a temp for several months, so we're very glad to have her.
Thank you. Welcome.
And I think, Mr. Burnett, you have a new staff member to introduce. The funnest job in the city.
Good evening, Council. I'd like to introduce to you Jesse Ashbaugh. Jesse is our code enforcement officer. He's also helping out with some planning things. He's been with us for about 2.5 weeks. Jesse's a Ferndale resident, and so I think it was important for him to come and work in the city that he lives. So,
looking forward, Jesse.
I guess there's sort of a yin and yang to life. You hire some and you, well, somebody can fire in this case. We have retirement to announce. Shirley?
Where are you?
A month forward. Shirley Zimmerman has been working for the Ferndale Municipal Corp since 2001. That was quite a memorable year. I heard that you, you know, the first time you were in my radar, you were in a band.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. It was for a street opening, and I thought, who's this really talented musician? So maybe, is that your new life after this life, perhaps, more music?
Well, definitely.
Oh, very good. Well, I also heard that during the recession, when things were lean and tight over the police department, you just about did just about everything extra up there. Perhaps you can help build that thing. I'm not really sure. But the city of Ferndale, the city council, the staff, and the city want to thank you for your good and faithful service to the city. Your class act. We want to give you a commemorative coin. This is cool. This is almost worth quitting over. But
okay.
Thank you for
retiring. Oh, very nice. Thank you very much. Thank you for all your hard work. Thank you. So, thank you very much for this. This is nice. And, it's been a pleasure to work for the city of Ferndale all these years. We also have two new staff members that hopefully you'll be introduced to. We have a new court services manager who's taking my position, Faith Miller, and also Tammy Smith, who's taking Faith's position. So they're both working now in the court. I just wanted to say, I don't know any of you hardly, and I don't think you know us at the court, but I do want you to know that you have a third branch of the government, and it's the court, and you have a municipal court judge, you have a court services manager, you have a courtroom clerk, you have a prosecuting attorney, you have a public defender, you have a probation officer, you also have a DV advocate. So that's a whole other department out there that I'm just not sure all of you are aware of, but it would be just a real pleasure if you did kind of say hello to these people every once in a while. They're We're just all out there doing our own business and don't really need to connect with you a lot, but I know sometimes we feel a little out there. So that's all I have to say. Thank you very much. Pleasure.
That's a good reminder. Thank you, Sherry. City Council, we're now on item D, the consent agenda. I would entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to adopt the consent agenda. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. It has been approved and adopted. Going on, we have a proclamation. Seems like we just did a poetry proclamation. I get to do another one, and it goes like this. Whereas the Academy of American Poets established the month of April as National Poetry Month in 1996, and whereas throughout history, poems have been tucked into pockets from commonplace books of the Renaissance to pocket-sized books of World War II, and whereas in partnership with New York City Departments of Cultural Affairs and Education, the Office of the Mayor launched Poem in Your Pocket Day in 2002 as part of the city's National Poetry Month celebration. And whereas in 2008, the Academy of American Poets took the initiative national, encouraging nationwide participation of individuals by open readings from poems in their pockets, now therefore I, John Mutcher, Mayor of the City of Ferndale, do hereby proclaim Thursday, April 28th, 2016 as Poem in Your Pocket Day in Ferndale, Washington. I call upon all public officials, educators, librarians, businesses, and citizens of Ferndale to participate in Poem in Your Pocket Day as an innovative and joyful celebration of the unparalleled wealth of poetic language written, read, and shared. And pulling out of my pocket and provided for me by Marla, thank you so much, is a poem by Theodore Retke, and it goes like this. The Waking. I strolled across an open field. The sun was out. Heat was happy. This way, this way, the wren's throat shimmered. Either to other, the blossoms sang. The stones sang, the little ones did, and flowers jumped like small goats. A ragged fringe of daisies waved. I wasn't alone in a grove of apples. Far in the wood and nestling side, the dew loosened its morning smells. I came where the river ran over stones. My ears knew an early joy. And all the waters of all the streams sang in my veins that summer day. Thank you. Thank you, Marla. Now we can go home. You've had it all, haven't you? 2 in 1 month from there. Going on to item F, discussion on transportation 101. I assume Mr. Burnett and maybe Mr. Burnett mostly. And I'd like to request, if council would allow us, to save questions to the end. A presentation is going to be given to us, and we'll have plenty of time to ask your questions. So jot them down, and we will get to them.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Good evening again, Council. For those members of the audience, I apologize because I'm probably blocking your view a little bit, but we don't have great audiovisual equipment yet. We will hopefully soon. So again, we're trying to illustrate the need for that.
After the toolbox.
So Transportation 101, the reason why we're wanting to present to you Transportation 101 and then 201 and 301 is in recognition of the fact that while many on staff and many on council have gone through this kind of laborious process of figuring out how to deal with transportation, which is probably the biggest single issue in Ferndale or maybe the one of the more complex, that many of our council members haven't been through it. And rather than staff presuming that the new council will agree with absolutely everything that the former council or administration or staff recommended, to start with Transportation 101, starting to talk about some basic concepts, and then we'll graduate to 201 where we can really apply it a little bit more directly to Ferndale and then beyond. So We have, there are six different subjects there, and I'll try to go through them as quickly as possible. Each one of them, as you can imagine, probably has a book or several books talking about it. You can get in-depth on all of these. Going to try not to at this point, but certainly when we get to the questions, we can try to answer them or we can provide some additional information. So I'll get right into it, starting with level of service. So level of service is something that actually applies to not only transportation, but most of the other services that we provide, which is really how do we measure success? In this case, how do we, it's a measure used to relate the quality of traffic. One of the most important things with level of service, which is measured on an A through F scale, is that really what we say at the bottom is the adopted level of service, what we are saying is our goal, is not necessarily the worst case. It's what we are willing to pay for. So that's where, and I'll talk about this in just a second, you might see some cities that have an A adopted level of service. They're willing to pay to create that level of service or to preserve it. Other cities, like Bellingham, in some places have an F level of service, which means that they are not willing to invest in that type of infrastructure, at least, to make it, quote-unquote, better. So, going to our next slide. The A scale, I'm not going to go through every single one of these, means free-flowing, where there are very few cars on the road. And here's an example. It's in Asia someplace where a dictatorship decided it would be fantastic to make a 10-lane road, never mind the fact that many of their citizens ride bikes and do not drive cars. So there you have an A level of service, which is great, but it's also bad because it's overbuilt and it's a poor use of taxpayer funds. It's that balance that you're really looking for. Conversely, you could have an F, where you are using the maximum capacity of your road. There is a vehicle on every square inch of that roadway. It can also be used as a kind of advocacy tool because no one wants to stay in that gridlock traffic, so people start making other decisions. They start making decisions to carpool, to use mass transit, to do commute trip reduction. Maybe they work from home. Maybe they leave early. So F, yeah, you are using the maximum capacity, but sometimes it is to transition to that other form of transportation. And this is kind of what Bellingham has started to do, where they are deliberately, in some cases, allowing the roads to get to gridlock in order to introduce or to emphasize biking, buses, and other things, where if you don't like it, find another way of getting around. The con is for those people that still continue to drive vehicles, it's a breakdown in the vehicular flow where you cannot rely on getting from one place to another within a certain time frame. It is no longer convenient. Again, you know, you go to Seattle, and this is the choice that they have made, that these people and these governments have made, is you are going to spend a significant amount of time in traffic in exchange for possibly being close to high-paying jobs, to entertainment, to other things. So it's a choice. Neither one of these are worse than the other. It's a choice that that jurisdiction has made. In the city of Ferndale, we have adopted a level of service C, which translates to flows that are at or near speed limit. Some days it won't be. Some days it'll possibly be faster than the speed limit. That there would be limited ability, though, to maneuver within a traffic stream where you're busy. It's not that it's free-flowing. You are going to have stops and starts, but overall, on average, over the 365-day period, you're going to have close to near-speed limits. We in Ferndale have said that the priority is going to be given to commuters along major streets. So what that means is along Main Street, Vista, and Slater, that the folks that are going east-west, with the exception of Vista, where you kind of go every direction, those people get priority, whereas those people on the side streets, especially along Main Street, who choose to go into Hagen's or Sonic or wherever, they've made the choice to encumber themselves with an additional delay where it might be more difficult for them to get back into traffic because the folks that want to just get home are given that priority. And whereas there are a lot of different ways to measure level of service. One of the more typical is to measure the worst delay at a stoplight, which is typically the left-hand movement. How long are you going to need to wait there? What we do is we measure it based on corridor travel time, which means how long does it on average take you to get from point A to point B. Again, that emphasizes that east to west direction. So here is a screen print from Discover Ferndale where you see the east-west traffic on Main Street. And here's another depiction of that, and I'm looking for my handy-dandy light switch thing. It's probably in the big box. Oh, thank you, sir. So what does level of service C translate to? It means that you're going to have speed limits of between about 17 miles an hour eastbound to 22 miles per hour westbound. And I know what one of the questions are, or one of the statements, that's not the way it is on this day or that day or the other day. I know, and we're going to get to that later. And something to remember with level of service is generally you measure, what you measure is what you get. So if you're measuring the delay at intersections, the project to correct that is more intersections, typically, or larger intersections. If you're measuring volume to capacity, which is what the county does, you end up having more capacity. I think that this is similar to what WSDOT sometimes measures, where you're going to have more lanes on your roads, because that's what you measure. With travel time, you typically measure, you typically result in projects at choke points, but there's a little bit more variety there, where it's not limited to the intersections. To cure that east-west or the travel time, you could add new lanes. You could put in new roads in other locations. You know, we heard this evening. What about Thornton? Yes, that is one of those options, is you create that alternative. And then there are hybrid approaches as well, from signal coordination. I don't know if the council's ever heard of signal coordination, but that's something that we're looking at. To access management, to on-street parking or removing on-street parking, to intersections, to any variety of things. Our measurement allows us a lot more variety than other measurements, which is a good thing. There are definitely some bad things about it, but we do have many more options than just saying, where are we going to build this other intersection? So that's level of service, briefly. We now move to intersection improvements. And one of the things that we've talked about at length is when we are talking about intersections, roundabouts versus signals, which is better? And we're not going to resolve that today, because there's a lot of literature from people who spend all of their time studying it that argue signal is better than roundabout, roundabout is better than signal. What the city has determined is that we will have to reject roundabouts before we consider signals because of some of the advantages that roundabouts do bring with them. They are a more efficient way of moving vehicles through an intersection, simply due to the fact that you will always have multiple vehicles within the intersection at one time, whereas with a signal, you're only going to have them coming at each other, more or less. The accidents are less severe. These are all proven over and over, and there's really not that much debate about these. The accidents are less severe because you don't have the head-on collisions. Again, it facilitates multiple vehicles within the same intersection. It's low maintenance, where if we have our power down, the roundabout still functions exactly as it would on a day like today. And they're fuel efficient, where you don't have folks idling. You have people constantly traveling. Disadvantages? They are more costly to build. That's in terms of both laying down the infrastructure, but also the design, because each roundabout needs to be different. So you need to measure not only at the intersection, but all the way back to determine deflection angles, to determine right-of-way, to make sure that as people are going through, they're not going 50 miles an hour and they're not going 5 miles an hour, so they hit the sweet spot of about 12 to 15 miles an hour as they're going through that interchange. They can't be easily expanded. That's another negative, where if you have designed it for this precise type of movement, adding another lane to a roundabout is difficult unless it was designed already, whereas with signals, You can calibrate the signals. You can add a new lane often. I think that that's actually a positive here, low maintenance, all weather. So we'll ignore that for a second. They do tend to prioritize dominant traffic, and this is an important point to consider. If you do have a dominant direction in the roundabout, and you'll probably have seen this, you'll tend to have that constant cycle of that movement dominating, so it might be sometimes challenging for people on the side streets to get in. It can be designed to accommodate that through slip lanes or other things to allow the less dominant side to be able to access in without being forced out. But it is something to consider in the design part of it. And, of course, it can be confusing to new users. And that doesn't just mean people that aren't familiar with roundabouts, but people who aren't familiar with a particular roundabout because they do have some nuance to them. How many lanes am I looking at? Do I get off on this one? How many different places can I leave? Where are the pedestrians in there? And actually, I think that that might be where what I forget here in low maintenance, all weather. A poorly designed roundabout is not as friendly to bikes and pedestrians as a poorly designed signal because there is that constant movement and it does prioritize the motorists. Doesn't mean that you can't have a roundabout that's designed to accommodate pedestrians and bicyclists well. It just means that it is something that you need to take into account. Moving on to signals. Well, signals do give equal priority to all movements. They have a light that tells you when to go. They do use relatively less land area, although you can certainly have signals that take up a lot of land area. They're familiar to folks. We have 100 years of driving on signals in the United States. And so it tells you what to do. This is also an advantage of roundabouts moving back is they keep you alert. You're looking when you're at a roundabout. You're not on autopilot. Signals an advantage. They're programmable. And they are not only programmable at the beginning, but if you have advanced technologies that we're talking about, they can be relatively dynamic as well to adjust to different timings of the day or traffic. And they are relatively bike and pedestrian friendly. Disadvantages, sometimes when these folks who are at a signal are on autopilot, they tend to keep on going through a red light and plow into someone head on. That's not a good accident. At least half of all the movements are stopped at one time. That's the nature of signals, as they platoon folks through. They don't function, or they sometimes don't function well in all weather conditions, where when you run out of power, all of a sudden you turn into a four-way stop. I'm sorry?
Or not.
Always stop. They should be calibrated to other signals so that one signal doesn't have green and the other says red. And then again, they are bike and pedestrian friendly. Again, I think I left some advantages on there. So that's the difference between roundabouts and signals, and I will read what that says because it is not as clear. We move to this next one where we're talking about how our 6-year plan and our 20-year plan link together. So we're moving relatively fast here, but I think that that's what we want in a 101 class. So our public works director is going to talk more in depth about 6-year plans and 20-year plans at an upcoming meeting, wanting to tell you a little bit about what this says right here, though. And actually, I might get out of here and just adjust something real quick. There we go. And you can't see that. All right, so the 20-year plan is a comprehensive plan that we're talking about. The 6-year plan is probably something that you're more familiar with because it comes to you each year. The 6-year plan talks about those projects that we plan on doing within the next 6 years. Generally, these are projects that we have some level of design already. Maybe we have some funding that's committed to it. The 20-year plan, on the other hand, has broad descriptions. It's based on our modeling, and it says at some point in the next 20 years, you're going to need to do this project. So it has those planning level costs where Transpo or Wilson Engineering or Reichardt and EB have said, based on 2016 dollars, it's likely going to cost about this much. based on all the roundabouts in the region, a two-lane roundabout in Ferndale is probably going to cost about X amount of money. We talk about the general funding strategy, where for all of our projects, this project's probably going to be paid for partly by traffic impact fees, and we hope to get grants for it, and maybe we'll use some other money. We identify basic low and high priority in the 20-year plan, and again, we list all of the projects in our 20-year plan. The idea there is that then when we decide or find that we need to do a project, we can pick it out of that 20-year plan, and we've already done a significant amount of pre-planning for it. It's not something that we pull out of thin air. And that's one of the problems that we have had historically, is sometimes council and staff have said the six-year plan is the focus, where we interject projects that are sexy. Maybe you got elected because Thornton was a huge, important one, and we're going to do Thornton. Thornton's on our bucket list to do, when possibly Thornton is not actually necessary for 15 or 20 years, but it happens to be the sexier project as compared to signal upgrades, which might be necessary now, but telling your constituents that we're going to switch the timing by about 5 seconds on a signal in most cities would not be all that exciting. So that's where the six-year plan needs to be consistent with the 20-year plan, and the 20-year plan needs to be able to then speak to that six-year plan as well. And then, of course, once you get to the point of being ready to build, you generally have your design complete, your funding secured, and you can then tie it into the comprehensive plan. Now, there are some cases where it makes sense to put something in a six-year plan without tying it to the 20-year plan. And a fantastic example is a crosswalk at the library, where we didn't have that in our 20-year plan. All of a sudden, we got funding from an outside source. If we'd waited to put it into our comprehensive plan, it would have been a year or so, possibly. We decided to move forward with it and do it, and that makes absolute sense. If something's breaking, maintenance, that makes absolute sense. But generally, you want it to go through the whole cycle, because that way we can demonstrate for grant funding, they always say, is this included in your comprehensive plan? That way we can demonstrate that long-range thought process. And then we can show consistency, that we actually build the stuff that we say we're going to build in the 20-year plan, and that folks like on LEGO, which has been on the six-year plan for about 20 years, will have some expectation that we finally made it to the six-year plan, so it might actually get built. And is one of the problems with animations. That one worked, though. So moving on to concurrency. Concurrency says, and I'll read it, the goal is to assure that those public facilities and services necessary to support development are adequate to serve that development at the time it is available for occupancy and use without decreasing service levels below locally established minimum standards. So this is a requirement of Washington State, and it's a requirement for transportation only, although it's optional for all of our other capital facilities. And what it's saying is that the city will constantly measure traffic as it comes through and measure that against our adopted levels of service, so that when the aggregate of development that comes through starts to drop us beneath that level of service on Main Street or on our side streets or on Vista, that we will break the glass and we will start that planning for that project. Not only the planning, but we're going to start the design, because it has to be in place within 6 years. Again, 6 years. 6 year capital improvement plan, 6 year transportation improvement plan. That's not an accident. It's saying once you drop beneath level of service, you will put it on your plan if it's not on there already, or you'll place a moratorium on development, or you will change your method of level of service, likely reducing it down. So this is a state requirement, and we are fully compliant with that requirement, where right now, according to our measurements, all of our roads are at or above our adopted level of service. That was a quick talk on concurrency. This talks again a little bit about how then the 6-year and the 20-year relate, because again, concurrency is a part of it, where you always start off saying, what do we have right now? What's in our plan right now, and is it still good? You then talk about what are your level of service goals? What is success as defined by our council? And you say, well, do our existing facilities function? Are they functioning as designed, or do we have things that are breaking? Our signals are breaking. They're no longer working as designed. That's a problem. Note it, and we get to it in just a second. You then start looking at growth, and that's where the land use element, which talks about growth and where it's going to be located, comes in. We say, okay, here are the impacts of that future growth on the existing facilities, and does it break? Well, so we determine the projects necessary to maintain that level of service. We're going to be bringing you those projects at Transportation 201 coming up. You determine the cost and the financing strategy for those projects. They say, oh, gosh, you know, we're going to be needing to spend $200 million on traffic to maintain our level of service. That's too much. We're going to look at reducing or changing our level of service, or we can do that. We're going to be looking at increasing traffic impact fees or doing this, that, or the other. We then go to our approved 20-year project list. There it is in the comp plan, and from there, each year, we determine the 6-year capital or transportation improvement project list based on the funding and the need that we have. So we might have the need sometimes for a project, but we haven't dropped beneath concurrency, but we might not have the funding. That's going to be a decision. Does it go on a 6-year plan where we're not going to build it, but darn it, we need to build it? That's going to be your policy. Funding strategies. So we have the Washington State Department of Transportation construction cost indices, and that goes all the way back to 1990. Here's the Growth Management Act here, and here is the 20 years. So over the last 20 years, you can see how the costs have increased over time. Sometimes they've decreased. Here's the recession. Here's over the last couple years. Look at how fast that increased. So the construction cost index inflation, it's almost tripled compared to normal U.S. inflation, which is less than doubled. That means that the cost of doing these projects is growing more rapidly than the value of our money, or put some other way possibly. But it means that it's getting more and more difficult to fund these projects, and at the same time, we see grants and other sources of revenue going down. So they're going in opposite directions from where we'd like them to be. For funding, we have four major sources. We've got grants from the federal, state, and local levels. We have traffic impact fees, which are optional, allowed under Growth Management Act if we have a GMA-compliant comprehensive plan. The city of Ferndale has a transportation benefit district. And then we have city funds and in-lieu fees that are not necessarily as predictable as some of the other sources. So grants, and I'm by no means an expert on that, you have Tiger grants and a variety of safety grants, MAP 21, Federal Highways Administration, Safe Roads to School. A lot of these are looking at a very specific goal. You know, does this put people back to work? Does it take you safely to school? Does it cure an existing deficiency? Quite often, and I'm certain not in all cases, they do want something that's more shovel ready, so that it's not 20 years out, but it's something where we've already done some analysis to show, yes, this will have the desired benefit in this particular application. State and local, the Public Works Trust Fund is no longer funded.
It's gone.
There are some other grants available, but those are drying up too. Typically, state grants do require inclusion in the comprehensive plan to say, you need to plan for long-range growth, and we're not going to give you funding unless you can. The same way as you can't charge impact fees if you don't have a GMA-compliant plan. That's one of the reasons why the county cannot charge impact fees.
And if I could just throw in a little bit. Not only, you know, looking at that funding portion of it, what funding mechanisms are available, but depending on how we put the project together, we either have have a project that's going to be eligible for federal funding or not. Depending on how we put the project together, we could have a project that's eligible for federal funds or not eligible for federal funds. Projects are managed a little bit different, so if we're envisioning that we're going to apply for federal funds, we have to go through a much more stringent process than we would if we're not. And then also, you know, as Yori was saying, there's a lot of them that are shovel-ready. We do need to have them on our six-year plan for inclusion in that. And then also the classification of the roadway. And one of the topics that we were talking about with the transportation engineers today was the classification of the road and what funding mechanisms that makes available. For federal funding to be an option, it needs to be a federally classified road within that federal classification. So there are a lot of factors that go into what funding mechanisms are available, and trying to pick the right road and the right funding package and then applying for those is kind of a juggling act in some cases.
And there's also a choice sometimes where some of these grants might come with strings attached that might make sense for the grant but might not make sense for the city. So an example would be, do we want bike lanes on this particular road, where a grant might say you must put bike lanes, but maybe it's on a road that would be absolutely would not make sense locally for those. So that's a decision-making process that Public Works goes through, which grants are appropriate. So traffic impact fees. You hire staff in order to be staff that are intelligent enough to make the decisions on what grants we go for, what grants we don't go for. Believe it or not, that's one of the reasons why you hire Kevin and Katie and Wendy and all those.
Those other people.
Traffic impact fees is where this council has the extreme decision-making ability. Where do you choose to place that traffic impact fee on the spectrum of where you could place it? Then you trust us to apply that as you intended. So, things to know with traffic impact fees. They're only for improvements related to new development, which you can kind of think of it as, does this expand the capacity of the network versus is it a maintenance thing? Is it simply replacing like for something similar where you're not going to get more vehicles through it? If it's not capacity related, it's probably not going to be eligible for traffic impact fees. So Church Road is a pretty good example there. It did add a third lane in there for turning, but otherwise, all of the improvements, you just had two lanes anyway. You're only going to get the same amount of traffic going up and down. So that wasn't one. I think that there were some traffic impact fees that could have been used for it and possibly were used for it. But overall, that was not a traffic impact fee-related project. As compared to Thornton, which is hugely impacted by development or for development. It shall not exceed growth's proportionate share, meaning that in any road, it's not just going to be new development that uses it. If Thornton goes through, we haven't heard probably from those people that are going to be living in the new homes that are going to be using Thornton. Yet you see on social media, folks, whenever there's a Thornton discussion, existing residents are saying, I can't wait to use it. So we can't charge development the full costs of Thornton because our 13,000 people are going to be using it as well. So it has to be that proportionate share. It shall be used for improvements that reasonably benefit the new development. So in Seattle, this really comes into play, where if you're doing something up at Northgate, you cannot say that stuff down by the stadium district, you can't use the impact fees from Northgate down in the stadium district, because you really can't tie those two together. In Ferndale, we're small enough where we are the same road network, where except for in some really unusual circumstances, like Grandview, let's say, we can probably say that the new development is going to utilize this road in some manner. So we have that flexibility to be able to port those impact fees around a little bit more. I want to give you a brief history of impact fees or traffic mitigation over time. And this is one of the more complex slides, so I'll take you through it. So prior to 1973, that's before we had SEPA, which is the environmental checklist where we say, because you're developing, you're going to need to mitigate in this manner. Before that time, we didn't have much as far as regulations. So developers would come in and some would say, I need to put this new road through. I need to put Ferndale Terrace in to serve the road, the people that are moving in. So you kind of have some spikes where they might do all of the work. Then you have other folks that say, hey, he just put that road in. I don't need to do nothing. I'm just going to build my houses. So then you see the valleys in there too. Then we had SEPA that says, city, you need to ask them or you need to determine what kind of impacts they're going to do and what kind of mitigation measures they're going to do. So that gave us the ability to say, you're going to need to do more than you ever thought you would. And then you have another staff member that says, I didn't really even think about it that much. It wasn't consistent where you would say, that this guy's not going to have any impact, so we're not going to make him do anything. And then this guy is going to be the first one, and he's going to have to do everything. So up and down, up and down, up and down. 1998 is when we had our first traffic impact fees. Towards the tail end here, we started to make it a little bit more consistent. But 1998, our first traffic impact fees. I don't know the exact number. These percentages are just general. But that council at that time said, more or less, we're going to make development pay 25% or 30% or whatever was the share of those developments. So on that date, that's when the developers paid the most in terms of traffic impact fees. And then we didn't maintain it for 12 years. So as inflation happened, the value of those fees went down. Because we charged them $100 here, we charged them $100 here, when that $100 was only worth $70. 2010, we went through a long process with council, with the public, to determine what are we going to do. We could have charged 50%, 60%, whatever was reasonable and would pass muster. We ended up at about 35%, and we didn't maintain it for a couple years, which we said, that's okay, but it gradually went down. Then we went through the Main Street Master Plan. We updated it. We spiked the fees up a little bit because of the projects that were included in the Main Street Master Plan. And then we updated it again a little bit last year, and we're going to update it this year. But every time that you update it, there is going to be that slow decline during inflation. That's just the nature of the beast, but it's something to know happens. That's why you need to update it on a fairly regular basis. So some of the other funding strategies, Transportation Benefit District adds 0.02 sales tax for road projects, 2015, $410,000. It's useful for relatively small projects, for grant matches. It's been incredibly successful, I think. In-lieu fees, less successful, a lot less successful, where the applicant pays their portion generally when a city project is pending. So if we say, let's say that we're 5 years ago and we were going to be doing the Main Street project and we have a development coming in that they would otherwise need to do improvements. We would say, we don't want you to do your 150 feet of frontage. You pay us the equivalent cost of what that would be, or 150% of that cost, and we're going to put that into our fund because we're going to do that project. Over time, what we have done, Portal is a good example, is we've said, tell you what, you have a skinny frontage and it's a deep lot. We don't want you to put in 100 feet of that frontage only to have about 50 feet of it torn out by the next guy as he goes and he matches you. So we're going to take your funds and we're going to hold it. And then when we have a project, we're going to do all of you guys all at one time.
Yeah, I'd say that Portal Way is a really good example of in-lieu fees and some of the issues that there are with them is that when you look at a project coming in and doing in-lieu fees on Portal Way or even installing the frontage improvements, we have quite a few projects right now that are going in that we're requiring them to put the frontage in as they come in to do the project. But we lack a cohesive master plan for Portal Way. So where do we put the storm drain? How do we tie those storm drains together? Where do we put the curb, the gutter, the sidewalk, the bike lane? What's the road width? These are all things that have been identified for Portal Way. We kind of know what the parameters are. from some of the things that are existing out there. But it's hard to plug in these little sections. So it's an area where in-lieu fees would be good, but at what point do we come back and then do the project? Or does that money evaporate and go to another project in another area?
Is there a time frame, like, so say if a big box store comes in on by Anderson Paint Company, and there's traffic, you know, situations that we know need to be changed, are they obligated to, like within 5 years or something like that, to help with that?
Well, with the in-lieu fees, our code specifically says that if we're going to charge in-lieu fees, that the project has to be identified within our on our six-year plan, and is envisioned to be constructed within 2 years. So that's the ability that we have for knowing that we have an upcoming project, and since we don't have that design done, saying pay us for, you know, and we go through and do an engineer's estimate on it so that we know what we're charging the developer to do. But they have the ability to pay that so that when we come in and do the project. But it's seen as that short-term gap between, you know, we know that we have an identified project. We know we're going to be moving forward with it. And we don't want to put in part of it just to come in and rip it out into our project. So there's that portion of it. And then I think that the question you're asking may be a little bit divergent from that, in that do they then have the requirement to do it? And we would require that they put in the improvements at the time that they do the development, or in lieu fees, but not a...
I thought if there was traffic situations were identified after the construction, that they have a certain time frame that they have to help pay for some of these things.
It's really the closing the barn door after they've already come in. If Pilot is an excellent example of that, possibly, where we had the Eagle truck stop where they had a certain amount of traffic going through, and Pilot said, okay, we want to come in and rebrand it, and we're adding a new passenger vehicle pump, or two new. And so we had them do a traffic study, and they said this is the amount of traffic that those additional pumps would generate. It turns out that just adding the Pilot name didn't change the infrastructure that much, spruced it up. Quintupled their traffic. So they said, here's how many new trips are going to be generated by it. And we said, yep, that passes muster. And we had our consultants look at it. That passes muster. The fact that they generated so much more than that, we asked our attorneys, can we go back and say, this is different? There's way far more semis there, and it's actually impacting. They said, you lost your opportunity. So that's where it is so important to look at their traffic impacts and to second guess them, and to take that as far as we need to if we think that it is wrong. Pilot was a tough one because it was a relatively unique circumstance, but things like box stores, the good thing is there are thousands of those box stores, and there's verifiable data where if they came and they said, actually, our Ferndale box store is going to generate 20% of what we see in all of our other stores, we would say, no, that's ridiculous.
Council, let's allow staff to finish. I know they're just about done, and then I'm writing down questions. Write down your questions, and they'll take every one of them. Mr. Burnett?
So I think this is going to be the last section, modeling. I have books and reams of paper that Transpo has sent us about the background of what happens once we give them inputs. And we can share as much of that with you as you want. But it's important to talk about all the work that does go into it, and what they tend to use and how they look at it, where it's not a video game. And I think that a lot of times we've seen some of those things, that the models that have the cars going around, that's not the most accurate model that they have. I mean, those are models that are used to show something to decision makers, where they're not as powerful as some other models that are more numbers-based. You know, it goes with a whole bunch of other things like that. Simulations generally are binary. They're ones and zeros that an expert goes and deciphers, whereas the models that you see are not as accurate. You know, like the modeling in the movie Armageddon, which is, you know, about space and stuff. looked great and made them $200 million probably was not that accurate, but it made it look cool. So the model is developed first based on existing traffic counts, where what Transpo or another consultant would do is to, they would try to replicate the existing traffic counts in their model, and they'd run it over and over again until it works. So they would know that we have 100 trips on Vista, we have 200 trips on Main Street, and a lot of other places. So they would continue to manipulate it until their model reflects 100 there and 200 there. Run it over and over to make sure that there aren't mistakes or kind of whispers in their model that are wrong. And then they would say, okay, we have now modeled existing conditions. We can replicate existing conditions, so we have a good baseline. Then they say, okay, where is the traffic coming from? So they have a TAZ, or a traffic analysis zone, which is more or less a traffic watershed, where you take the trips that are coming out of this sub-area of the city, and you more or less say, we know that all of the trips are, or most of them, are going to end up on Church. So here we have the east side of Church, north of Main Street here. We know that almost all of the trips are going to end up on Church. Actually, and this isn't necessarily accurate, because about half of them go to the east. But so what Transpo would do is they'd say, we're going to have 100 trips coming out of this TAZ 314. 60 of them are going to Church, and 40 of them are going eastbound to Shannon and Ferndale Terrace. Those are some assumptions that they plug into the model, and that they have looked at the existing to say, okay, that works. The 60-40 split works. Then they say, all right, let's add growth. In one of the PDFs that I have, we have about 10 of these pages. Here are each of those traffic analysis zones, and we have about, I think, it's 250 or 300 of them in the city. We then have the different types of land uses broken down by NAICS categories. Education, insurance, real estate, I forget what that is, service employees, government employees, manufacturing, retail, all that. Each of those have different characteristics. When they come and go, how many trips an employee would tend to generate, where some of you have seen the traffic engineer's handbook, where we say, okay, a 100,000 square foot store is going to generate 500 trips an hour, or 50 trips per 1,000 square feet. There are also calculations that say retail per employee, that it would generate approximately 30 other trips from customers. So they take all of this information, they know what TAS it is, and then they start plugging that into the model. These are numbers that we give them based on Whatcom County's growth allocations and then our land capacity analysis, where we say, okay, we're not going to have a ton more development in that kind of Shannon Church area because it's already mostly developed. But there are some TASs, like at the intersection of Main and Church, where it's undeveloped. So I look at it and I say, okay, there's probably 50 units there. 50 units times 2.02 or whatever it is, and we plug it in here as households, and then they add that into the model. Layered on, I just talked about that. Then Transpo says, okay, we've layered that in, and now we've identified where your system starts to break or what the level of service is resulting from that growth. And so we've got A's and B's and C's in the green. These are all above our adopted level of service. Then we have D's in the yellow and F's in the red. Those are where we have projects that we need to do things. 2036 baseline. These are all good. These are good intersections. We don't need to do anything there unless there's a life safety issue. Here are the intersections or corridors where we do need to do something based on the modeling. We project the future level of service. They identify the projects necessary. And then we go to... Success. Then we go to Transportation 201, where we're going to start talking about those draft projects. So that's the presentation.
Council, thank you for letting the president. I'll get to you, I promise. I appreciate that you let Yuri complete all that. Please let the chair recognize you. And just a quick comment. I'm going to try really hard to give everybody a chance to ask questions or speak first before a second time. You might remember that from Roberts. This is new for me, so I hope you'll indulge. I'm going to try to give away a chance so everybody can participate. Staff, do you have anything you want to add to that before we go to council?
Yeah, just quickly, going back to Councilmember Taylor's question about traffic impact fees. Not absolutely sure about the time frame, but it used to be, it might have been modified here recently, it used to be that transportation impact fees had to be spent within 5 years. Now, if I pay transportation impact fees and my business is here, those fees don't have to be spent here, but they have to be spent. And, in fact, I think it was Bellingham, or I'm sure other cities, but I think we remember that you just can't hoard your traffic impact fees. The concept is spend it. And I think there were some developers who actually were able to show that given the amount of traffic impact fees that were generated over a certain time frame versus the traffic impact fees that were spent from that point forward, they showed mathematically. We've never had a problem with that. We've been pretty good about spending our traffic impact fees. But there is an outward limit on, you just can't collect it and keep it.
Mr. Burnett.
Well, and one of the reasons why we have not needed to refund them is because Bellingham still bases their impact fees on their 6-year plan rather than their 20-year plan, which is what we do. So if for some reason they can't do a project on their 6-year plan, which is a lesser amount of projects, they're all of a sudden possibly finding themselves, we don't have anything to spend it on. With our 20-year plan, we have a broad list of projects where we could say, okay, gosh, we can now pull this one from the 20-year plan to the 6-year plan, spend those traffic impact fees, where it's absolutely appropriate to do. We just have more options by doing it that way.
Council, questions or comments? There will be a test afterwards on Transpo 101. Councilmember Goodrich.
I may have not understood this when we talked about the 6-year transportation plan and looking at that every year. But I don't remember us ever saying, well, gee, what's our 20-year transportation plan and how does that relate to our 6-year plan? It seems like we just looked at the 6-year plan and then we would say, well, gee, shouldn't we do something with sidewalks? Okay, we'll add that to the 6-year plan. I just don't see it. I don't remember us ever saying, well, this is our list on the 20-year plan. This is the list on our 6-year plan. Let's pull something off of 20 and put it into the 6, unless previous public works directors did that for us when we presented the list. Am I remembering that right? Or
Steph, wouldn't that be in the comp plan, the existing comp plan?
I'll take it.
You want to arm us support?
We could have done better at that, I think, and I think that there maybe are could be different perspectives, but the 6-year and the 20-year can be more closely related, and the GMA calls for them to be more closely related than they used to be. And I think that Kevin is really working on bringing that together.
Well, and I think there's, you know, when you look at that 6-year versus the 20-year plan, there's a lot of projects on the 20-year plan that are, you know, laid out as we should do this at some point in the future. And then we get to the 6-year plan, and it's like, this is really broken, and we need to fix it. So a lot of times that immediate need overtakes the long-term need. And with, you know, the limited amount of financing, we prioritize based on what we see is that most immediate need that may not be on the 20-year plan. But, you know, the goal is to incorporate both the long-term needs for the system with the short-term needs to fix things and find a balance to where we can get all of those needs met in some capacity.
It seems like, to me, listening to this tonight, is our 6-year plan is also our 20-year plan. Because there are projects that are on that 6-year plan that have been on there longer than 6 years. And so it's kind of like, well, we'll put it on there just to make the public happy and say, yeah, well, someday we're going to get to this road. So we'll put it on our 6-year plan so people see that, even though we really don't have a plan to do it in 6 years.
Yeah. I one way to think of the 20-year versus the 6-year is we just can't pick a transportation impact fee amount. We can, but you just can't say, we want it to be $3,000. Your traffic impact fees, when you look at your 20-year list, and then you present value the cost, and then you determine, we talked about the growth allocations, how many households, how many businesses. You come, Transpo ends up with a number. If you want to do all of these projects for over the next 20 years, and if you have this level of service that's driving these projects, with this many, with Ferndale growing at a certain amount, best they'll tell you what the fee is. I forget what they said the fee should have been last time we did this, but you have the ability to say you can go less than that, but you can't go more than that. So if our 20-year plan says that if you charge $5,000 a trip today, you should be okay, you can't say, well, let's charge 10. So the 20-year plan sets the upper limit of your transportation impact fee. It's that overall. The 6-year plan, theoretically, everything on your 6-year should have originated on your 20-year if you do it right. Every so often you get a project that just kind of bumps up. But in a practical sense, the 20-year plan is what you hope to do in your lifetime. The 6-year plan is what you hope to do in your term of office. I mean, it's almost that easy to break it down that way, because each year when we bring up that 6-year list, you guys think, okay, what do I want to get? What do you think we can literally get done in the next 6 years? Not all of them get done, but it is a more smaller, workable, theoretically more important when it comes to your decision, because you're the ones that decide to go on the 6-year. Our consultants come up with a 20-year list, but you then say these are the ones that are the most important.
Councilman Watson.
I have a question about the concurrency. We were talking in Public Works how, because of with Main Street Bridge just having two lanes and Main Street being the way it is, there's not that much we can do as we continue to grow. So what do we do in that situation where concurrency says you're not allowed to keep developing if you can't fix the roads and have the traffic flow, but if we're stuck with a two-lane bridge and a Main Street that we can only do so much with, where does concurrency fit in?
Well, so there's the GMA, and then there's the actual projects, where GMA is more the planning, and then Kevin is the Public Works, and how do we actually figure a way out of it? GMA says if you are dropping beneath level of service, if the consequence of us being constrained like that means that we cannot achieve our level of service through any sort of projects that we could reasonably do, then we would have the choice of either reducing the level of service or changing the measurement, where down to F, again, we could go, or adopting a moratorium until such time as we can cure it. What the city doesn't have the option to do is to stop growing, or else we would find that we would be not eligible for grants or impact fees and would be effectively sanctioned by Washington State. So if we were to find, okay, gosh, as we found about 10 years ago, we had a sewer line. We had inadequate sewer in the southwest part of the city. We placed a moratorium on development in the southwest part of the city until we did the project that we knew would solve it, and then we opened it back up. I don't know we're to the point of exhausting all of our possible projects, but I would think that the next step would be, is there a level of service change or reduction before we consider a moratorium?
So you're saying if we had a moratorium on a type of development, like housing, we couldn't have transportation impact fees for housing, but you could still have transportation impact fees for retail. Yes or no?
I don't believe that would be the case, because the road doesn't know that it's from a house or retail or from Alcoa or from BP. The road only knows that there's a vehicle on it.
So if we took, say, we're going to take 2 years off and not have any new developments, we're not going to approve anything new housing-wise, we couldn't charge transportation impact fees anywhere in the city because we're choosing not to let people build. Now, there'd still be building houses. They just wouldn't be any new approvals, no PUDs or whatever.
We would probably need to go through an exercise of either not charging impact fees or determining what part of the city development could occur that does not encumber Main Street, and it would need to be a moratorium on all developments, not just residential, that mm-hmm. would impact Main Street. Because statistically, residential right now is creating a significant portion of our new trips, But if we did have the big box come in, or if we had another fast food store come in, a fast food store generates about the same as 40 houses. So if we had Avenue Bread downtown, if we had a library, it would be about the equivalent. So we'd have to look at those equivalencies.
Council, questions? Councilmember Olson.
The slide with the sliding down fees, why couldn't we have it in others, why couldn't we add an adjusted for inflation clause in there? So we don't have to play this game all the time.
I had the same question.
I think that we could. I'm trying to think of any reason why we couldn't. What one of
projects get completed.
Projects get, yeah, that's actually, projects get completed.
And also we're basing the traffic impact fees off of an identified cost that we developed through the process of doing the comp plan. So you'll see on the project list for the 20-year that not every project is eligible for transportation impact fees. And the ones that are go into the calculation. That calculation is based upon the work that we're doing. And right now the project cost estimates that are worked into that are all using a consistent methodology to establish what the cost is, you know, what we're doing with projects. Is it a new intersection? Is it widening a roadway? Is it redoing it? Is it just adding sidewalk? So when you look at that cost escalation, it's, you know, you need to go back and look at what the estimate for doing the project is. It's developed
sure
a little bit more.
I'm not sure we're talking about the same slide.
Okay.
If we have a decreasing amount of revenue for our, where we're actually losing at, say, 2015 or 2012 to 2015, and we're on the downhill side of that, well, how do we avoid that without having some sort of, unless you want to do this every year, is that our alternative, is do it every year? What I'm trying to get to is...
Right, no, I understand.
So we're not down here.
I understand what you're saying, and it's based off the fact that we establish the fee, and then inflation goes up, which decreases the value of that
Correct.
Dollar as time goes
Correct.
On. And what I was illustrating was that the basis of that fee was an exercise that we went through identifying the project and identifying the cost components for that for those projects that are involved in the calculation of that fee. And it's, I think, a little... It's not as simple as just adding a cost escalation factor onto it that would keep it consistent with.
So I think, staff, is there a remedy for that? This is utterly predictable to us that our buying power will decrease over time. Is there a way to...
Yeah, I think this is something we'll throw to Transpo because they work for a lot of different mm-hmm. businesses. I think there's a way.
I think that's a good question.
Yeah, well, we really do.
And fair, you know, we do want to possibly balance... Is there consistency from the development community where, gosh, you know, you change it every 6 weeks versus, you know, the city losing its ability? Because what we don't want to do is just depend, if we were even to do it for inflation, just depend on that. Maybe we allow that in an odd year, but every even year, updating it based on the real numbers. You know, so mm-hmm. it keeps it basically level.
Fresh.
Yeah.
So maybe we can come back with some options like that. I think it's a good question. Council, more questions? Staff?
Is anyone else?
First-timer? Councilmember Watson.
With the TIF being the proportionate share, we'd always kind of talked about the developer paying like 50%, but on that slide it looks like they're not actually, they're paying, what, about a third of the costs of the project?
Yes. So
okay.
That is a policy decision. The upper echelon of what is reasonable, what I've heard is the 30 to maybe even 60% could be argued to be reasonable.
I guess I thought there was something with the code, the Washington code, that it had to be, couldn't be over a certain percentage.
It's reasonable. It's
reasonable.
The wording that they use,
okay.
Which leaves it to the courts to then determine based on the specific community. Gosh, you know, you're growing barely at all, and yet you have high impact fees where you're expecting development to cure these existing deficiencies or other things. That's not reasonable. Oh, you're one of the fastest growing cities in Western Washington. most of your transportation projects are growth related and would not be necessary if not for growth, yeah, higher is better. So, and I think that the city administrator or someone else alluded to last time, we came, there was the option for the previous council to select a 50% or a higher fee, which, ignoring the numbers, it was 50% or whatever, ended up looking at, it was 3,500 or 5,000. Mm-hmm. 5,000 is too much. Who cares if it's 20% or 60%? 5,000 is too much. I feel comfortable at less than 2,000. And that's what we ended up with. That happened to be around 30%. Even though we probably could have gone higher, we probably could have gone lower.
Because I think it would help to know what percentage it was, rather than, because I think we got into how much it was it going to freak people out money-wise, whereas I would like to have the discussion, what portion are they going to pay? I mean, because 30% does not seem like that much.
Would you like to have the discussion before we introduce the possible costs and to say, council has said that 35% mm-hmm. makes sense, then we come back to the next one and say, okay, 35% equals this.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it will always come down to your discretion. As we know, I don't think there's a developer that's been born yet that will say that our fees are not high enough, that they shouldn't be less than, in fact, the fee that they all want, just like taxes are zero. But you all need to feel comfortable enough, and I know that's a hard thing, but you need to feel comfortable enough that you have a fee that's sufficient to generate significant dollars, but not so significant that you literally, choke the development off of the city. If hindsight is any sort of illustration here, as we've all been hearing, we're growing very, very fast. We also have, I think, the highest transportation impact fees in the county. So did we find that sweet spot? I think some people could argue yes. Could it have been a little higher? Maybe. Could have been a little, there'll be a decision for you guys to make. It's one of the hardest ones, because as Yuri mentioned, it's one thing to kind of mentally say, oh, 35% seems just right, and then all of a sudden you hear that that's 5,000, 8,000. It's some huge or comparatively huge number. And most humans being what they are, they go, well, 35% would have been good, but we have to be real about this. And so what's 30%? What's 25%? It's... There's no magic, there's no law that says it has to be a certain amount. It just, the fee can't be greater than what your experts are telling you at a maximum you could charge. So you can't charge, again, a $20,000 impact fee if your project costs show that if you charge $5,000, you'd be disqualified.
And council, this is rather safe here to talk about this, and an innocuous experiment. But I never got more phone calls from developers and an attorney when we went to level of service C. Wind and dine, that you can't get level of service C. I said, we're going to try our best, but this is easy to talk about here, but when we get up to those impact fees, let me know if I'm wrong, but you'll get phone calls from developers. Councilmember Olson, then Councilmember Goodrich.
Well, mine was on the same topic. I don't know if you're going to change topics or not.
I'm going to explain it for the new people. What they don't want to say is we paid Transpo a big pot of money to give us a figure. And they gave us a figure. And there's just a few of us that were on there. And we chose to ignore it. And so we went way lower than what should have been based on all the math. There were people that were saying, oh my God, the sky will fall. And there were more of them than there were of us who said, that's the figure they gave us, let's go with it. And that's how we came to be, and now that's where we're at.
Mr. Goodrich.
Well, I was going to kind of, it goes along with that, though in the fee discussion, if my memory serves me right, a lot of it discussion was how much to add for Thornton. And it seemed like Thornton was a big, because of it's so out there in the amount of money that it costs to do it, that when you brought that into it, that caused the fees to jump up, and that was part of the discussion, I think, of, well, why are we charging $5,000, using that number, you know, we'll charge $2,000 because we don't see Thornton as being a realistic thing in the near future. You know, that it's all of a sudden becoming, you know, a deal.
Mr. Burnett, so, I remember that discussion. Go ahead.
We had about $100 million in total transportation improvements, and Thornton was about 33% of that. So it was a significant, and since it was almost entirely growth-related, it had a huge impact on the impact.
Yeah, and what the council decided to do was, originally the concept was to not just go over the railroad tracks and then swing down to the roundabout. It was to go over I-5 and connect over to Portal Way, which, as I think as anyone would realize, that's a much more expensive. And so the council made, I think, a fairly prudent line of reasoning insofar as the odds of us getting the money to go all over I-5 is pretty remote. It's probably more realistic, and back then it was still kind of pie in the sky, but it's more realistic if we just go over the railroad tracks and down there. So we had Transpo back out that incremental cost for over the freeway, and so our transportation impact fees, the fees that they suggested, were dialed back slightly to account for not the full Thornton over the freeway, but instead Thornton just over the railroad tracks. So you make those, and Thornton is a great example because it's one of those unique big ticket items. Otherwise, if you've probably seen the map, we have, I don't know how many, we probably have, I don't know, 50, 100 projects for the next 20 years. None of them are to the magnitude of what Thornton represented.
And both Councilmember Olson and Minister Young are correct that Transpo came back and said, this is what you need to do to cover it all. And we were about, I think we were about 1,900 of trip, or whatever it was, 2,000, and I think they wanted us around 35 something. And we found that, as this council often does, tries to find that what they felt at the time was a sweet spot. Mr. Burnett.
One of the things is that was in, at the depths of the recession. It was also, we were coming out of the time, we charged about $2,600 per trip now. At that time, we were charging in some instances less than $100 per trip. We had not maintained our system, so we needed to, in some ways, catch up. But the best time to build a project was always yesterday, right? So if we look at when we adopted our plans, we were at about 225 of these units. Now we're at 279. So it's increased by, a quarter over the last couple of years. So it becomes increasingly more costly to do these projects. So when we have something like Thornton, which is a ways out there, one of the things that council might wish to consider is how do we accelerate possibly those projects so that we can use the power of today's money to pay for them rather than 2030 money where we're only getting pennies on the dollar.
And a great illustration of what they're talking about is we have unique impact fees at the I-5 corridor that we don't have anywhere else. I don't know how much higher they are, but they're significantly higher because we did the study and proved that that's what needed to be done there to mitigate what's going on out there. So you can do some special things, but you have to back it up. Councilmember Olson.
When did we last update the fees?
2012. We last updated all of them in 2012, early 2012. We updated our residential last year to catch up to the rest of them.
So is it time to...
After the comprehensive plan is adopted at the end of June, then we'll know the project list. And the reason why we wanted to have this discussion now is so we don't come into a situation where we say, hey, remember that discussion that you might not remember that you had 3 years ago? There you adopted the projects where now you must adopt these traffic impact fees. You still have the ability and will have the ability to say, we know that by adopting this project, it's going to have a consequence as far as traffic impact fees, which you would probably adopt in July or maybe even August of this year.
Thank
you. Council, any more Transpo 101 questions before the quiz is passed out? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank
that
you.
Was really wonderful. Thank you. Appreciate
you even think you get to stay up front, don't you? You got utilities next?
I go to utilities.
I believe so. Thank you, Council. Comprehensive plan element, utilities element, amendment. So the element, item G.
So this is going to be hopefully pretty short and sweet. The Planning Commission has recommended that the Council start deliberating on the utilities element of the comprehensive plan. The idea is that we'll have this meeting. We'll hear any feedback from you on the utilities element. then it's going to go back to the Planning Commission where they're going to make the changes that you recommend, if any, and then they'll have a public hearing. It'll come back to you in June, and then away we go. Incidentally, we talked with all the other planners, and we are ahead or at the same level as everyone else right now. A lot of them are looking at July for adoption, so we're in a good situation. The utilities element of the comprehensive plan is not water, sewer, and storm, which we typically think of as utilities. You can still continue to call them utilities all you want, but in the context of the Growth Management Act, utilities are electricity, natural gas, cable, telephone, that sort of thing. And those aren't things that we directly control. Those are done by quasi-public or private companies, usually with a franchise agreement through the city. That also includes garbage as well, I should say. So our responsibilities aren't necessarily to plan for how these services will occur, because that's the responsibility of these companies. Instead, our responsibilities end up in some ways, and this is one of our questions, being how do we make sure that those utilities don't take advantage of the city or our citizens, and how aggressive are we in protecting our rights and our citizens' rights through our franchise agreements? And then does the city wish to be involved in providing these utilities? The example that we've given is municipal fiber or broadband, where we might be able to provide information at lower costs, or the access to information at lower costs than Comcast or others that might charge a lot or might throttle the amount of information that you can get. That's especially important for a lot of businesses or 21st century businesses that really depend on having that transfer of information rapid and cost effective. The third element that the city can be involved in is what can the city do to preserve our interests but also not get in the way of these companies, where these companies are wanting to provide their services as efficiently as possible, we believe, and they typically need to go through our permitting and our encroachment process with us. They also need to participate in our capital projects, where they come in ideally, and this is ideal for both the city and for these utility companies. They want to know about our capital projects on our 20-year plan and our 6-year plan as far in advance as possible so that they can prepare to extend their utilities in concert with us doing our capital project, so that they then don't need to go back in and cut through our facilities, weaken them after the fact. They're on the same page as we are. We're working on different ways for our project map that we're going to be displaying early next month, where they're going to be able to see online that 20-year and our 6-year projects. And then they're going to be able to communicate with Kevin and Katie and say, hey, we see that this is coming up in 2 years. Here's how we want to be involved. So that's kind of it in a nutshell for the utilities. Wanting to hear how aggressive you want us to be as far as franchise agreements. And these are where we would find in our goals and policies, do we want to be an advocate for our citizens, or do we want the state's attorney general to be more the advocate against unfair practices or complaints or things like that? How do we want to use our franchise agreements? And then is there anything else?
Any more from staff before we go to council? Great. Councilmember Olson?
How specific can you get? For example, could we demand that you provide a phone number for an on this country customer service? Because I just spent better than 2 hours this morning trying to figure out why I pay for 50 megabytes per second internet, and I had 1.2. And I went to 2 different continents, and I still don't have an answer.
I don't think I have an answer for that either. I do know that, you know, the one instance that I've been involved in most recently was with the city of Mount Vernon and their requirement with waste management that they provide a local contact for recycling complaints. And
yeah, something like that.
It was a provision in the contract. That's a little bit different scope of service than the franchise agreement where we're dealing with Comcast or with the phone provider. A lot of the provisions in the franchise agreement relate to how we work together, like you already mentioned with the projects and how they have the requirement to come out and move their facilities during a construction of a capital project. I don't know. I'm not an expert on the franchise agreements.
Well, perhaps it's something that...
Right now, and I think
research.
Riley had looked at it a little bit, is that we're currently kind of expired on those, and that's...
We're up for renewal.
Up for renewal. That,
yeah.
So these are things that, this is something that we want to investigate, then we'll definitely pursue that.
Yeah.
As we go forward with the renewal of those agreements.
Councilmember Watson.
And I was wondering, too, as part of our agreement with Solid Waste, if there's a possibility for them to provide recycling at our parks as well as the garbage and recycling. When you're there at the Pioneer Park, any of our parks, you have a hard time even finding a garbage can, but recycling would be nice. Just as part of the agreement. We wouldn't pay for it. They would just do it.
Those are the best sort of agreements.
Those are the best agreements.
Well, the comparison is Comcast, where Comcast has said that they expect that they will provide cable and other services to municipal buildings, and that...
Yeah, that was recently, just before my departure from Skagit, they had renegotiated the Comcast agreement, and she got some fairly good concessions out of Comcast for their participation in Skagit 21, which is their public access TV system, as well as cable connections for various facilities around. So those types of things are well within the scope of that franchise agreement, and we can look to get some of those concessions for moving forward with the franchise agreement.
Like the library, they would provide, so the library wouldn't have to pay for the high-speed internet at the library? Because that's used by a lot of our low-income citizens who basically don't have it at home, or even people who just live... If you live right outside the city on Mountain View, you're not going to get as good of internet.
Yeah, and the broadband internet services are handled by a different franchise than the cable services, so even though they do come from the same provider, that's a different franchising type of agreement.
Mr. Sweeney.
However, the money for public access television does come from the cable TV bucket, so it's possible we may be able to peel off some of that.
Councilmember Goodrich.
Just one thing to follow up on what Councilmember Watson was saying. Some of that trash in the park is picked up by our city employees, then taken to a big dumpster.
Okay.
So at least I know Pioneer Park is. So there is, the SSC doesn't come inside the park. They just come pick up the big dumpster.
I guess I would like them to give us recycling bins so that we can also have bins in the park, but they would come pick those up.
My other question I had is, I know a while back that we were approached by a guy that wanted to put wind turbines throughout the city and stuff like that. I just got this earlier today. I haven't had a chance to go through and read it all. Do we address alternate energy sources like wind and solar farms and things?
A little bit. So we're wanting to put in the goals and policies a closer working relationship with Puget Sound Energy. But right now, the most benefit or the most cost-effective alternative energy solutions are to residential development. That's where most of the incentives are. They've said that for solar, especially, wind energy in this area is not that reliable.
It was this winter.
But that solar is where they really want to place an emphasis, as well as not for just residential, but commercial too. And so continuing that relationship with them, they have a program this summer that we're expecting to hopefully work with them on, which is going and doing those energy audits. They did an informal energy audit actually with our services, where they can do it remotely and they can see, about how cost effective we are with ours. But what PSC has said, and actually what all the rest have said, with possibly, well, not even the exception of solid waste, is that it's difficult to plan 20 years in the future. And we have the example in there where
We last updated this in 2005, where we said one thing you can count on is that the landlines for telephones are going to increase, you know, proportionate to the amount of growth that we see. A couple years later, smartphones were invented, and landlines have decreased where from 100% saturation now to like 64% saturation in households. So they've said, we can't plan 20 years out. 6 years out, yeah, we would love to plan 6 years out. We're 2 years or 3 years out. So they all said, Comcast said, we're going to be here and we're going to be servicing you. Maybe we're going to be in a different name, but there will be our ancestors servicing you. We have no idea what products we're going to provide to you. Might be holograms. So
there you go.
Yeah, it brings up a question, though, on two things. One is, can we require alternative energy sources? Like if Big Box A comes in, can we say you need to have solar, some sort of solar generating aspect to your building or parking lot, like where they put the car covers that are actually solar panels or something? And the other question that you sparked me, when you're talking about landlines, is that the telco landline or is that the landline you get with Comcast that you have to bundle in so that you can get the lower fee?
Yes. The answer is yes to your last question. It's both, where they do bundle it in for you, and I think it.
If I have a landline with Comcast, there's no phone number connected to it.
Right.
I just got it so I get it cheaper overall.
Well, in Pennsylvania, Verizon line workers just went on strike, you know, because they were saying there's not enough work for us. Verizon is acting like there's not enough work for us to do, and Verizon is saying, kind of, you're dinosaurs, but we're not going to say that because some people still want you, just not as many as there are right now. Can we require alternative energies for commercial? Eagle is about as close as we could get to it, where we can't compel them to make these decisions, partly because it does cost more. The return on investment isn't as great. Sometimes the return on investment on some of these technologies outlives the expected lifespan of the building itself or of their use. But we can incentivize it. Again, going back to grants, a lot of medical buildings or others that depend on grants from the government has incentivized them going after LEED, leadership in energy and environmental design, which takes into account those renewable resources, saying if you're going to be building a new medical building and using federal dollars to do it, it's going to be designed to these higher levels. That's about as close as we can get, because otherwise it's...
Councilmember Birch?
Say a restaurant closed, which it did,
mm-hmm.
and somebody bought it, which they did.
Say it's Babe's Restaurant.
Say it's Babe's Restaurant, and they want to pull in gas, natural gas, and update all their electricity. How does our utilities, how do you fit into that? Do you inspect that, or do you work with the utility companies? What roadblocks do they face?
Right. Well, so I'll talk specifically, but it's also kind of a general question, too. We don't handle electrical here. That's the State Department of Labor and Industries. Gas, and we don't look at cable and other things that much
right.
either. Gas, we do where we would be looking at the mechanical fixtures where they would need to get permits for those, and then we would test, do pressure tests and other things on that. We would typically be working with Cascade Natural Gas, but really the applicant would be the liaison between the city and Cascade
mm-hmm.
on that. What happens in this specific instance is we have a building where enough work that would have required permits started to take place, which unfortunately got them in a position of needing to comply with the existing building codes. We are working with that owner, and we're working through a number of intermediaries, too, if they can get a third party to analyze it, to demonstrate that they can avoid things like sprinkler systems, which we ran into with Pioneer Pavilion, as
right.
you know. we would be more than happy to see that happen.
And this isn't not quite related to the utilities element, but good question anyway. Any more questions from council? Councilmember Watson.
Just real quick, so this fiber optic, do you see us owning the hardware, owning the fiber optics and the servers and all that, or do you see us trying to incentivize somebody putting fiber optics in and maybe the downtown core or the I-5 core? I'm trying to understand where we would fit in. Are we going to incentivize, or are we going to try and own it?
And I'll speak first, and then I think Riley has more information than I do. Okay. One of the good things with the comprehensive plan is we can throw an idea out there that it might not be practical in 2016, but in 2018, things might start to crystallize. And maybe that's where we start putting in a six-year plan or something like that. As far as the specifics.
So there's a couple of options out there. What's nice is we're not the first community to look at this. So some outsource it to a private contractor that installs and maintains it. Others, the city owns the servers. They treat it just like their roads or their water system, that it is a publicly maintained utility. Wherever you see that philosophically is a decision for you guys.
Yeah, that'd be a long discussion.
Yeah, to put it mildly.
Any more questions on the utilities element of the comp plan? Thank you, Mr. Burnett. Fantastic. Very, very good. I think there sure still should be a quiz. I think we're down to mayor's reports. I have two. First of all, one of your members has been selected to receive the Community Leadership Award from the Washington Association of School Administrators. And so I'd like to join with you in congratulating Councilmember Watson for that recognition. Oh. Did you know you were getting it?
No.
Oh, we were told. I guess I have a secret source there. Very good. But congratulations. Your example of leadership and volunteering are commendable for all of us. Appreciate it very much. The only other news I have is I am leaving for a few days, and Councilmember Olson is in charge. I told him if there's an earthquake or a fire or a flood, just to clean it up before I get back. Mm-hmm. So you are in charge.
Oh, baby.
We shall go to council reports. Anybody? Oh, come on. It's always the least one. Okay. We'll go to staff reports. Mr. Burnett,
no.
Community Development Director, Public Works, Treasurer, City Clerk.
Okay.
Communications officer must be something on Star Park.
We're at 34% of our volunteer shifts filled. I'd really like to crack 40% before the end of the week. So if you all sign up a friend with or without their consent, I would sure appreciate it.
Lots of donations and food and great people chiming in. It's been fantastic.
So the food's in good shape. The meals are coming together.
Getting there.
I would like a few more groups to sign up and commit to meals. I'm not as panicked as I was last week.
Okay.
Can I join
you? Yeah, please do.
Those who are part of the Kiwanis probably know this better, but what we had originally thought would be great is if church groups could bring food. Mm-hmm. They cannot bring food unless it's prepared in a commercial kitchen. So that means that we're either in a position of having not just the potlucks, but actually...
There's some wiggle room in that.
There's some
depending,
tiny,
I wouldn't take that wiggle room.
Yeah.
Well, for example, some of you know that Greg and I have been teasing Avenue Breads a little bit about moving to Ferndale, and they're going to supply a meal just from the contact with them. So, very good. Mr. Sweeney, anything else from the great Administrator Young?
I'm happy.
No. Are you really?
That's really a good one.
Wow, I've got to write this down.
And our chief of police. Beautiful. Thank you. I would entertain a motion to dismiss.
Adjourn.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Council, have a great week.